Tariff war, global slowdown, Brexit, none of it has flustered the American shopper until maybe now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, October 16th. Good to have you with us. Now, amidst all the worrying things about the global economy, consumer spending has been solid as a rock. Until today. The Commerce Department reports that retail sales fell 0.3% in September. Economists were expecting the opposite, a 0.3% increase in retail sales. Now, there are always some nits to pick with the data, but the big takeaway was less spending on the extras, the discretionary stuff. And that could suggest that the good old confident American consumer might be starting to have some doubts. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Today's retail sales news wasn't all bad. Consumers were still spending it up on some discretionary categories, clothing and accessories, bars and restaurants. But a lot of other categories were weak: electronics, appliances, sporting goods, home and garden. Camilla Yanishevsky at CFRA Research says consumers are worried about the future.
Trade tensions are going to continue to weigh on consumer wallets. We're expecting to see more pullback, similar to what we saw in September, into next year.
36-year-old Carolyn Sharp of Studio City, California, has been pulling back. She and her husband work in the entertainment industry, and a few years back, business was booming.
So we moved to a nicer apartment, and we both replaced our old beat-up cars, and we've really plateaued. And I don't know anybody who feels like they're on an upward trajectory.
In one sense, 45-year-old Jason Brown of Valdosta, Georgia, is on an upward trajectory. He teaches communications at a state university and just got tenure. But he says his income hasn't gone up much, so big purchases are off the table.
Perhaps I should be more careful about my discretionary spending. And I'm sure if my wife hears this, she will definitely agree.
But for now, he's not worried about pulling out his wallet for a meal or a night out. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now, as consumers had been doing all this spending up until recently, perhaps they've been financing it. Big banks have been reporting quarterly earnings this week, and one of their brightest spots is consumer lending. That's personal loans, credit cards, even auto loans. This week, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Citibank all reported they're earning more interest on consumer loans. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Banks are earning more from consumer loans in part because consumers have been feeling pretty comfortable borrowing money. Frances Donald is chief economist at Manulife Investment Management.
This appetite for loans, this generally strong spending that we've been seeing, is pretty reflective of the strong economy we've seen over the last 2 years.
And as the Fed has lowered rates, banks have been relying more on consumer loans, which aren't as directly linked to the Fed's decisions as other loans, like mortgages. Kent Belasco runs the commercial banking program at Marquette University. He says banks will keep pushing consumer loans as other sources of income dry up.
They still want to earn the income, so what they're going to do is they're going to get more aggressive on making loans to protect those margins as much as they can.
Those margins have been under pressure as rates have dropped. Nate Tobik, the founder of Complete Bank Data, says banks have had a harder time making money off of mortgage interest and loans to businesses.
They're not expanding like crazy, so capital expenditures have been pulled back. And with mortgages, rates are at historic lows.
As banks expand more into consumer lending, Kent Belasco says there is a concern that banks could lower their lending standards to attract more borrowers.
And when you do that, you do expose yourself to a little bit more default risk.
And as banks try to sell people more loans, he says interest rates for credit cards and other consumer loans could start to drop. So far, those haven't fallen as fast as mortgage rates. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, tech did not have a good day. Airlines couldn't lose. Everybody else just kind of sat tight. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back back to retail for a moment, where you can't talk shopping without talking Amazon. And Amazon's network of warehouses are the key to its operations. Products come in, get organized and boxed up, and shipped out to customers in 2 days or less. There are over 100 of these so-called fulfillment centers in the U.S., but they haven't always had a reputation for being great places to work. Workers have walked off the job in recent weeks in Minneapolis and Sacramento. Last year, there were those reports about employees urinating in bottles at a U.K. warehouse to avoid taking bathroom breaks. And to counter the bad press, Amazon is inviting more people in. It's now offering public tours in 23 of its U.S. warehouses. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes went along on one with some Girl Scouts.
When tour groups enter the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Edison, New Jersey, the first thing they get is a pair of headphones and a radio.
Oh, goodness. That is loud. There you go. Can you hear me?
Yeah. On this particular tour, Amazon guide Reagan Quilty is leading a group of Girl Scouts and me around the facility. We're listening to her by radio because the warehouse is really loud. Squeaking jacks lift up pallets of stuff, 12 miles of conveyor belts move bins of things, and periodically buzzers sound to let you know when a belt is stopping or starting back up. Amazon wants people to hear and see all of this. One of the company's stated goals in offering the tours is to provide more transparency into what it's like to work in a warehouse. In other words, they're trying to prove that it's not that bad.
This is a small part that they are trying to do to change the public opinion.
Sunil Gupta studies business strategy as a professor at Harvard. If the tours are successful, Gupta says they could actually make customers feel closer to the company.
It's like if you go to a restaurant and if you have an open kitchen where you can see the cook actually making the food, it suddenly tastes good. And in fact, there are studies which show that if you see something being made, it tastes different than if it's just prepackaged and shipped to you.
At the warehouse, tour guide Reagan Quilty walks the Girl Scouts through the process of sorting millions of items into Amazon's system.
Brand new items, and we're going to put them away.
All of the products in this warehouse are under 18 inches in length. They arrive from the outside world, jars of pork rinds, pairs of socks, tubes of caulk. Workers then place the items into slots and big towers of stuff called pods. Yogi Kotak, who's one of the workers, demonstrates with a Spanish language dictionary.
I'm going to pick up the item, make sure that item is not damaged, and then I'm going to scan the item.
As soon as she does, a clock appears on the screen above her, counting the seconds since she last put an item away. Amazon says it uses these kinds of timers to give employees a better sense of how they're doing.
Then I can pick up the next item, do the same thing, and continue.
Once Kotak is done, an autonomous robot moves the pod away. It will stay on the floor until someone buys an item that's stored in it, at which point it'll move to another worker, who begins assembling an outgoing order. When the pods are all moving around, they sort of look like blocks in a massive game of Tetris.
They have cameras on the bottom and on either side, so they can see where they're going. And you can see how these guys get very close to each other, but they're sensors, so they'll never crash into each other.
This choreography between robots and humans is one of the things that most stood out to the Girl Scouts on the tour. Marley Madureira is 12 years old and lives in Nutley, New Jersey.
I kind of expected like there'd be people, there'd be robots, but I didn't expect how much responsibility that would be going on to actually get this package how it is now. Now I feel different about my package and I kind of appreciate it more somehow.
Amazon says another one of its goals with these tours is to inspire kids. In the case of 12-year-old Sophia Matos, it might have worked.
I have hopes to become scientists one day, so hopefully, maybe even a programmer for the robots. That would be very fun.
The way automation is changing work, by the time Matos enters the workforce, being a robot programmer might be the only human job left in an Amazon warehouse. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Public school students, Girl Scouts and otherwise, in the nation's third largest school district will not be going to class tomorrow. Chicago Public Schools canceled classes ahead of a teacher strike planned for later in the week. The strike is over lots of things. Teacher pay, class sizes, services for students who are poor or even homeless, ultimately resources. Teachers across the country have walked out of classrooms over the past year over pay and the lack of resources they need to do their jobs. Steffi Groplant is a freelance journalist who writes for Vox, and she wrote recently about seven school teachers and the stuff they had to buy themselves for their classrooms. Steffi, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, tell me, what kinds of things did you find that teachers were having to buy for their classrooms?
So when a teacher walks into their classroom, really, by and large, what they can expect are the desks and the chairs. Sometimes pencils, sometimes paper, not always. It does vary district to district, school to school, but teachers are bringing in a lot of supplies on their own. That includes any other furniture, books, you know, the beanbag chairs, nameplates, all that stuff they're bringing in themselves. But even beyond that, they're also buying their own curriculum to support their classrooms, because often districts are not supplying schools with the curriculum that they need to teach those kids.
I mean, that is wild, the idea that it includes curriculum. And in some cases, really life supplies. Like you talk about discovering that teachers were paying for medication or glasses for kids.
Exactly. Every teacher that we talked to had some sort of unique story of an instance where they went above and beyond. The teacher that you mentioned who bought a student eyeglasses because he was painfully nearsighted. Another teacher that we talked with bought her kids winter clothes because they were Somalian refugees whose families could not afford clothes to keep them warm in Syracuse, New York. So she went to Salvation Army and she picked up clothes for them quite often.
And let's be really explicit here.
Yeah.
These teachers are paying for this stuff themselves, right? Or how are they paying for it? Because it sounds like fundraising is a big part of the teacher's everyday life now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it does vary. Schools often do provide each classroom with a stipend. That stipend could be, you know, a couple $100s. But the teacher I spoke with in the Bronx, whose classroom gets $250 at the top of the year, she said $250 really isn't enough. She goes hundreds and hundreds of dollars out of pocket to ensure that her kids have the other things that they need.
Mm-hmm. What's the long-term effect of this, do you think, of teachers having to shoulder this burden?
Teachers are historically undervalued. You know, teachers went on strike in Arizona, among other places last year. One teacher we spoke with was active in that strike. And she raised that, you know, a big misnomer with the strike was that teachers were striking for more pay. That was a demand, but it wasn't the main demand. The main demand was that they weren't being supplied with the curriculum and the resources that they needed to teach their kids. So when we say teachers are not getting the resources that we need, it's another way to say we're failing to give teachers the resources that they need. And when we fail teachers, we fail kids.
Steffi Grobe-Plant is a freelance journalist. She most recently wrote for Vox about the true cost of being a teacher. Steffi, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up.
When I graduated college, I didn't get a job. I started making YouTube videos.
From YouTuber to CEO. But first, let's do the numbers. Nobody liked that retail sales report. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points, although essentially flat, to close at 27,001. The NASDAQ was off 24 points, 0.3%, to finish at 81.24. And the S&P 500 sagged 5 points, about 0.1%, to end at 29.89. So retail, let's go shopping. On the discount end of things, Target rose more than 0.25%. Big box store Costco lifted 0.1%, but at the higher end, now they're feeling the discretionary spending squeeze. Nordstrom shed 1.7%. Online giant Amazon, though, up more than 0.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.74%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Transportation is the single biggest source of carbon emissions in the United States. Full stop. And most of that comes from the 250 million cars and trucks we drive every day. But sometimes you need to see something like that to appreciate it. So a new map is taking the national story of climate change and making it local. The New York Times created what it calls the most detailed map of auto emissions in America, showing a year's worth of pollution in every major city. Nadia Popovich is the graphics editor at the New York Times. Nadia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly does this map show us? Give us an example.
So we undertook this project that really looked to map transportation-related emissions, but specific to driving across the country. And that's because transportation is now the largest source of planet-warming greenhouse gases in the United States. And, you know, the bulk of those emissions come from our cars and trucks. So we spoke with some researchers at Boston University who have this big database of road transportation emissions, and it really provides the most detailed estimates available of local on-road carbon dioxide over the past three decades. You can really see it really fine-grained detail, these, you know, usually invisible emissions of CO2 from the tailpipes of cars and trucks at a really fine-grained scale. So you can see them in a way that is a little bit less abstract than you might be used to. You see them coming from the roads of your local area.
So what else is contributing to this spike? It sounds like it's a spike in transportation in some places. But what other factors are contributing to this uptick in transportation and emissions?
Yes, so, you know, we've done some things to try to drive down driving-related emissions. There are these national fuel economy standards that were put in place under the Obama administration, and they've, to some extent, helped dampen this rise in automotive emissions because these rules require cars and trucks to use less gas per mile traveled. But though our vehicles or new vehicles have become more fuel efficient, at the same time, Americans are driving more and they're actually purchasing larger SUVs and pickup trucks, which have lower gas mileage. We've also found that freight trucking is also on the rise. And all of this is contributing to an uptick in driving related emissions overall.
Were there any big surprises in doing this project?
I mean, I think it's just, you know, the sheer volume of driving that happens in America, as one researcher told me. You know, most cities really aren't like New York or Chicago or even L.A., more like a Dallas or an Atlanta where people are making these longer trips. And that means more driving, and that necessarily means more emissions. And, you know, while that's not necessarily surprising, I think it's really when you then take those same trends and flip them to the, you know, per capita way of looking, so per person, you still see these upticks, you know, smaller ones in kind of these denser areas, as well as like pretty large per person increases in some areas like a Dallas.
The piece points out that there isn't a lot of leadership from the federal government on this issue. What are cities and regions and even states doing to try to address this problem?
Generally, there's only so much cities and states can do about some of this. For example, doing things like providing tax incentives for electric and hybrid cars, building new subway, light rail, or even rapid bus transit systems. I think one of the newest proposals is from New York City. So in 2021, New York is going to become the first city in America to charge drivers a fee for entering very congested parts of town. So most of downtown and midtown, you're going to have to pay a fee for entering there during rush hour.
Nadia Popovich is the graphics editor at the New York Times. Nadia, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Over on my show, Marketplace Tech, we talked to California Governor Gavin Newsom about transportation emissions. It was all part of our climate series, How We Survive. You can find it at marketplace.org. These days, all kinds of people think they can strike it rich as a YouTuber or an Instagram influencer or a TikTok star. But the truth is, it's just as hard as it ever was to make it as an artist or musician or podcaster. Facebook and YouTube recently rolled out ways for fans to support their favorite creators directly, kind of like a subscription to an artist you like. But Jack Conte has been doing this for years. He's the CEO of Patreon, a membership platform that connects 100,000 creators to millions of fans and helps them get paid. It all started back in 2013 when Conte was a musician making videos on YouTube. Welcome, Jack.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So I think after all these years, we can now acknowledge that the creator economy is a real thing. And I wonder how you would describe Patreon's role in that economy.
Gosh, that is good. First of all, that's amazing to hear you say we can all acknowledge the creator economy is a real thing. I completely agree. I realize I'm a little bit biased. But for the last 20 years, creative people have been making stuff and putting it online for free because this, you know, mantra around all information should be free. And I think, you know, that there's wonderful things about that. And I agree that people should have access to education and all that kind of stuff. And artists need to be paid for their work. Artists do a ton of work, and the role that Patreon plays is it helps them build a business in addition to being an artist.
I mean, it is fair to say, though, that there still is, it's still as hard as it ever was to build a business. You know, knowing that not everybody's going to get famous and not everybody's necessarily going to be financially independent based on these models, how do you manage people's expectations? How many people really are making enough money to be self-sufficient?
The problem that we're solving is, so you're a creator and you're reaching thousands of people or hundreds of thousands or millions of people, and you're not getting paid. You don't have a monthly paycheck. We're not a place to find brand new fans if you don't have an audience yet for your work. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of platforms that are solving that problem. YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, DeviantArt, you name it. There's a bunch of great places to showcase your art and build a followership.
I want to ask about content and how you have, you know, Patreon has had, of course, controversy like every big platform around the type of content that appears and this, you know, the inevitable problems with user-generated content and user-based content. And I wonder how you see this problem going forward. Like, how are you going to continue to grapple with things that pop up on the platform that are controversial or unacceptable? How, you know, how involved are you personally in deciding when to ban a creator in some way? And how do you see that evolving?
Yeah. So I get escalation reports, and our executive team gets escalation reports when there's something that folks feel like is, you know, particularly risky, or this is going to be a big deal, or there's going to be a press storm about this, whatever it is. I have not vetoed ever a content decision made from our teams. We hire great people. We have great process that's very rigorous and very thorough, and we let them run. We're talking about people's incomes here. We're talking about a creator's living and livelihood. At the same time, we want Patreon to be safe, and we have no tolerance for hate speech. That's something I think other platforms have been behind on. They've been allowing their platforms to become toxic places. And we don't want that. I don't feel apologetic about that at all. We don't allow hate speech on Patreon. And if you disagree, that's okay, but just go somewhere else.
Do you think it's harder for you or easier for you based on the fact that you're not a distribution platform?
Yeah, it's so much easier for so many reasons. And not to say that it's easy. It's very, very hard. We don't automate any takedowns, for instance. Any time a creator is taken down off the platform, it's a human decision where there's been debate and a meeting and rigor and people have talked about it and examined the nuance of the issue. We're not running algorithms that are stripping away people's incomes. I think that would be a terrible system. And we have the luxury to do that because we're just operating at a much different scale.
And then finally, what's hard about your job? What keeps you up at night?
You know, I have been a creator for a decade. When I graduated college, I didn't get a job. I started making YouTube videos. You know, becoming a CEO, from this path of being a YouTuber is just a lot. You know, I work on myself all the time, and I'm constantly reading and trying to learn and falling on my face all the time. and I guess that's just part of it. But learning all that quickly enough to scale with the growth of the company.
Jack Conte is the CEO of Patreon. For better or worse, Jack, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out. Today, the Federal Reserve put out its Beige Book, its summary of business and economic conditions around the country. The report notes that it was a disappointing summer tourism season in Cape Cod this year. The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston blamed a strong dollar, sending tourists overseas, a tornado, and sharks. Great whites have been a lot more common in Cape Cod in recent years. There was a fatal attack last year. The Fed says the media may have been, quote, overly focused on shark sightings, but that's what they said in Jaws, too.
Larry, we have to close the beaches.
We gotta go close the beaches. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was essentially flat today, down 22 points. The NASDAQ off 24 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 down 5 points, about 0.1%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.